This is Audible.
The Locket by Richard Paul Evans, read by William DeFries.
Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord God giveth thee. Exodus, chapter 20, verse 12. Prologue. There are those who maintain that it is a shameful thing for a man to speak of sentiment, and the recounting of a love story must certainly qualify as such. But if there is virtue in Stoicism, I do not see it, and if I haven't the strength to protest, neither have I the will to conform, so I simply share my story as it is. Perhaps time has thinned my walls of propriety as it has my hair. If my narrative is, in fact, a love story, I suspect that the world will not likely recognize it, for pulp romances do not often push aluminum walkers or smell of peppermint oil. Still, there are stories that refuse to be interred in silent graves, like the lives who gave them breath. The story of Esther Hewish is such, commenced and concluded in a town born of gold, a mining camp cradled in the lap of the Ochre Mountains in the remote, windswept ranges of western Utah, the town of Bethel. Bethel is now a dead town, and its history is not one story but two, as towns may live more than once. In 1857, a tramp miner and sometime evangelist named Hunter Bell, expelled for card cheating from the nearby Gold Strike mining camp, was wandering in exile amongst the bulrushes of the Ochre foothills. He chanced upon a rich deposit of placer gold. Bell staked his claim and within a month was joined by more than 1,600 miners. Learned in the vernacular of the gospel, if not the spirit, Bell bequeathed town the biblical name of Bethel, the house of God. Though Goldstrike and Bethel were sister cities, they proved as different as siblings in character as in appearance. Bethel was staid and industrious. Her greatest structure was the local chapel, which, when resting off Sabbath, doubled as the town hall and a one-room schoolhouse. Conversely, Goldstrike's most resplendent structure was a honky-tonk piano saloon and brothel. It was a raucous haven of prostitution, gambling, and murder, aptly nicknamed by the Salt Lake City newspapers as Sodom West. As the larger and more accessible of the two cities, Goldstrike became the center of commerce on which Bethel relied for its train station, milling, and trade. A year after the turn of the century, as gold production in both cities started to decline, tragedy struck Goldstrike. A fire, started in a saloon's kitchen, ravaged the mining town. It was followed by an ill-timed flash flood that collapsed most of the mines and all but washed away what remained of the once thriving township. A baptism of fire and water, the area ministries claimed, was apocalyptic, having prophesied that a great scourge was sure to befall the decadent town. Bethel, though spared heaven's wrath, was no longer accessible by railroad and died as well, leaving behind only those too old or too broken, like slag tossed aside after being purged of its wealth. For nearly 30 years, Bethel, or Betheltown, as Esther and those indigenous to the small town called it, lay dormant, until 1930, when in the wake of the Great Depression, there was a resurgence of interest in the town's boarded-up shafts, and Bethel was reborn as a Depression baby. It was just prior to these days that Esther Hewish arrived in Bethel. The young, beautiful daughter and sole companion of an elderly man seeking fortune as a miner. Prosperity eluded the man, and time proved that his greatest wealth was his daughter, who, as he grew infirm, provided for him as the caretaker of the Bethel boarding house and inn. Esther was an elderly woman when I met her, in the last months of her life. She had become a recluse, preferring to our world an era that existed only in her memory, and in the diaries in which she chronicled those days. An era evidenced by a petite golden locket. It was an encounter that was to leave me forever changed. I believe it is a great irony that I learned of life from one dying, and of love from one so lonely. To everything there is a season, said the preacher, to every purpose under heaven, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to love and a time to hate, a time to dance and a time to mourn, a time to be born and a time to die. Those months with Esther were a season of all these things, and most important, the season I learned of faith, forgiveness, and second chances. One winter in a rest home called the Arcadia. Chapter 1. Bethel Town.
As I lie in bed, listening to the toil of my body beneath the infirmities of age, my heart wanders again to Bethel Town, and I wonder how it is that, through the same sorcery of time that has brought me to my end, Bethel Town has become less heartbreak than joy, and less memory than dream.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. Bethel, Utah, April 2nd, 1989. As the desert blurred past in the luminous hues of an impressionist's palette, Faye huddled tightly against the car door, her eyes closed and her coffee hair spilling over her face. The last of the music, frayed tones from a hayseed country station, had miles back degenerated into a storm of static, and now the only noises were the car's undulations over the primitive road and the occasional sigh of my sleeping companion. We had already traveled 50 miles past the last evidence of humanity, a rancher's lodgepole pine fence, into the desert's blanched, stubbled plain, and Faye had not yet asked where it was that I was taking her. Her faith in our journey was not unlike her faith in our courtship, attributable only to some godlike quality of the female mystique, an unwavering virtue of hope and patience that, if unable to predict our destination, found merit, at least, in the journey. I had never been to this corner of the earth. Only 8 months previously, I hadn't even known of its existence. But the stories I had heard of the dead town had given it meaning, and I confess anxiety at its approach. I was told that the town, steeped in the foothills of the Ochre Range, was constantly assailed by mountain winds. But there was no wind that day, and the spray of red dust in the car's wake hung in the placid air, liberated from a roadway not trespassed for a year's time. I was glad for this day, for its blanched, cloudless skies, for though I embraced the land's immense solitude, felt akin to it, it would be foolhardy to venture so far from civilization with the possibility of becoming stranded on washed-out roads. Flash floods were common in these regions, and most of the ghost town's abandoned mines had decades earlier collapsed under their turbulent runoff. The wash of such cataclysm was a souvenir hunter's ecstasy of relics and coins and an occasional grain of gold. It had always been such with the town, as men came to take from the land or to take from those who had come to take from it, and even in death it was so. Only today I had not come to take, but to impart. Before us the coarse road crested, then dipped into a barren creek bed, surrounded by the pink clusters of spring beauties and the scattered stalks of bulrush that proved the creek still possessed occasional life. At the creek's shallow bank, I left the car idling and walked to the rill and placed a hand to its stony bed. There was no trace of moisture. I examined our intended route, rolled back a single stone of possible hazard, then returned to the car and traversed the bed. A half mile forward, the timber skeleton of a gold mine stamp mill rose from a mesquite-covered knoll, a wood-tarred contrivance of rusted wheels and cogs and corroded steel tracks, over which ore cars had once rolled and men and horses had sweat. I glanced down to a crudely drawn map, astonished that after all these years, and with a dying memory, Esther had remembered such landmarks so distinctly. I wondered if she had just never left. At the mill's passing, I turned west and coaxed my Datsun up the hill, where the road vanished into a buckwheat-dotted plain that spread infinitely to the north and south, and climbed the foothills of the mountain into the town itself. As we neared the decrepit structures of the once flourishing township, Faye's eyes opened, and she slid up in her seat.
Where are we?
Esther's hometown. Faye gazed on in apparent fascination.
What's left of it?
We passed the ornamental iron fence of a cemetery. Welcome to Bethel, the house of God.
This is where Esther was born?
She came here as a young woman. I looked out at the desolate terrain.
Makes you wonder why anyone would come here.
Faye turned to me.
Why are we here?
To fulfill a promise. Faye leaned back in her seat, momentarily content with my ambiguity. I parked the car under the gnarled limbs of a black locust tree near the center of the deceased town and shut off the engine. The morning's drive had taken nearly 2 hours, but it was the conclusion of a much greater journey, one that had taken nearly half a year, a journey that began the day my mother died. Chapter 2. The Arcadia.
The Arcadia is unlike that chill, tile institution that I was brought here from. The small difference between it and a sepulchre was movie night.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. 6 months previously, October 30th, 1988, Ogden, Utah. For the third consecutive day, snow fell heavy in driven blasts that cloaked all that hadn't the sense or ability to come in out of it. From my perch at a shallow bay window, I watched the mortician's high-stepped approach through the piled snow. Tucked under the man's arm was a folded vinyl body bag. Mid-step, the heavy man lost his footing, flailed, then disappeared in a sprawl of slush and powder, then rose again, cursing as he brushed down his charcoal overcoat. Moments later, a gloved fist pounded against the door. The man was ruddy-cheeked and broad-faced. He was still breathing heavily from his hike, his breath clouding before him as I opened the door.
I can't find the street numbers. This the Keddington place?
You have the right house, I said.
Body inside, I reckon.
I glared at him. My mother is inside. The man kicked his boots against the threshold, then stepped past me into my home. He glanced about. The Spartan room was carpeted in a well-worn shag of olive hue, and bare except for three humble pieces of furniture. A wooden armchair, a garish red and gold upholstered sofa, threadbare in its extremities, and a single brass-stemmed floor lamp, its shade burned through where it had once fallen against its bulb. The room was illuminated only from the window.
Where's your mama?
I pointed toward the darkened hallway. The bedroom is there on the right. The man unbuttoned his coat but did not remove it, and stepped in the direction of my gesture. I followed him to the doorway. Inside the dim room, he moved toward my mother's body, shrouded beneath a hand-tied quilt of her own making. He pulled down the blanket, removed one glove, and placed two fingers beneath her chin, then looked down to examine her fingernails.
When'd she go?
I looked again at my mother's face. Just a few minutes before I called, I replied, glancing up at the shadowed face of the mantel clock.
Maybe 3 hours.
Coroner been by?
The certificate's on the nightstand.
Anyone else witness her passing?
No. We only had each other.
I'm sorry,
he said, and there was a trace of empathy in his voice.
No other family?
I have an uncle, but he's not family.
Where's your old man?
He died a few years back. Then I added, without thought, not that he was family either. The mortician's brow furrowed.
How's that?
I feigned the tipping of a bottle, a habit acquired through years of explaining my father's absence.
We hadn't seen him for more than 7 years before he'd drank away his liver.
The man nodded empathetically as he removed his second glove. He stood and walked to the foot of the bed, drawing the quilt down with him. He lifted his bag from the floor and began working it up over her body.
Don't mean to be judgmental, but for just losing your only family, you ain't seen much broken up.
I was too numb to feel slighted by his remark.
My mother has been dying since summer. There just aren't any tears left.
He closed the bag up over her head.
Yeah. Eventually, it just give out.
He stood back as if to examine his work.
There's a few papers you'll need to sign. Legal papers.
We walked out to the kitchen, and he spread the forms about the drop-leaf table, pointing me to the lines that required signatures.
This your place, or are you renting?
It's mostly the bank's, but we put a down on it a few years back.
Well, if you're thinking of selling, I know a good realtor. They've been tearing down these places and putting up mini-marts.
He sniffed.
Reckon you'll be head off anyhow.
Why's that?
It just always happens that way. Demons will chase you off.
Only the ones at the mortgage company. I haven't been able to work since she took to bed last summer. Between the medical bills and house payments, I'm pretty much buried.
I signed the last paper.
You get some employment in mind?
Whatever I can find. Work's a little scarce around here.
He reached into his coat pocket and took out a dog-eared business card, penning a phone number and address on its reverse side. He offered me the card.
Are you hiring?
Nah. That's the number to a nursing home. The manager up there told me just yesterday that she needed help. Tell them that Roger sent you up. They like me up there.
I don't have any experience with that sort of thing.
You've been at your mama's side since last summer. You got plenty experience. Tell them I sent you, he repeated. I'm kind of a regular.
What is the place called?
The Arcadia Care something.
I stowed the card in my shirt pocket, and the mortician stood.
I hate to impose, but could you lend me a hand here taking your mama out to the car? This blizzard is us short-handed at the morgue.
We carried my mother's body out under pallid skies to the back of the station wagon. The mortician secured the tailgate, then took a brush from his front seat and scraped his windshield. I watched from inside the house as the station wagon fishtailed from the curb into the icy roadway and took my mother away. I closed my eyes and wept. It was appropriate that Faye laid flowers on my mother's coffin before it was lowered into the frozen earth, as she had brought my mother flowers at each visit during the last months of her life. Perhaps even more appropriate, they were bluebells, for in the parlance of flowers, the bluebell denotes constancy and forbearance. The bluebell is metaphoric, too, of my mother's life, for once plucked, its nodding bells soon droop and the flower withers. I have seen photographs of my mother when she was a young and graceful woman with a beautiful face. An image she saw chiseled away a day at a time by the cold, sharp implements of travail. Her only sin, if it be deemed such, was in marrying a man who loved alcohol more than God and self, and the demons that haunted my father also tormented those he should have loved and sheltered. My mother sacrificed all to protect me from that torment, to fill her child's heart with hope when her own was broken. If I have accomplished anything in this life, it is to her credit, not mine. And if there is love in my heart, it is because she put it there. I do not know what requisite checklist is kept at Heaven's Gate, or, in truth, if even there is such a realm, but if there is, I suspect it will be filled with people like her. The instant of my mother's death should have been something indelible, something soulful like the open-mouthed wailing of the Aborigines, something worthy of a woman who suffered life storms as a shelter for her only child, and worried less about her hurt than that I might see her bleed. Her death should have been worthy of such battered nobility. Instead, I watched death's process with stoicism, and the final event seemed no more spectacular than the uneasy breaths of the minutes or months preceding. My mother had not died quickly, and my agony of her loss, like her breath, had been pilfered away a day at a time until all that was left was silence and the intense loneliness of resolution. Maybe it was because I had seen her die 1,000 times already. Maybe it was just that I thought any place else had to be better. During the last months of my mother's life, I kept to her side, isolated from the outer world and its movement, like the ice climber who, in the shadow of the glacier's crawl, seeks only to secure his own precarious purchase. The one exception to my seclusion was Faye. Faye had entered my world the previous summer by way of Heller's Grocer Mart, where I worked as a stock boy in produce. She had come to the store with her sorority friends, preppy, loud, flippant, and gorgeous. I stole glances at her as I stacked grapefruit on an inclined produce shelf. She suddenly turned toward me, and we shared brief eye contact before I turned away, embarrassed at being caught in my voyeurism, as well as my canvas grocer's apron. The next day she returned alone, looking for okra, and in an act of rare gregariousness, I mustered the nerve to ask her out, though it is possible that she asked me out. She later confessed that she had no idea what to do with okra, but had seen it advertised on a placard outside the store and found it as suitable an entree as any. We began seeing each other regularly about 6 weeks before my mother's illness took me from my job and the mainstream of society. I'd gone to lengths to hide our poverty from Faye, and when I had not called her for a week, she hunted down my home in our ramshackle neighborhood. I don't know who was more mortified. I followed her eyes as she gazed upon our ragged home while I offered a belabored excuse for not calling. Faye was clearly affected by what she saw, horrified, and I was sure I had lost her. I lied that I'd call when things were better, knowing that she would act concerned because she was a good girl, but my call would never come, and she would quickly paint over me. Though my heart ached, I would be lying if I did not admit that there was relief to get the inevitable over with. Rich and poor do not mix, and my family had always been poor. My father drank what little he earned, and my mother worked where she could, hauling her child with her to homes where she would shine floors and windows for people that lived in neighborhoods like Faye's, where poverty was obscured through thick country club windows, and the needy were more of newsprint than of flesh. When someone we love is dying, we do not ask doctors for a price list, and my mother's medical bills had forced me into still greater debt. I would have declared bankruptcy, perhaps should have, had my mother's ghost allowed. Even on her knees, my mother was a proud woman who lived in no one's debt but the Lord Jesus. In truth, my financial circumstances were the more easily solved of Faye's and my differences, for all it takes to solve poverty is money. There were greater deficits left by my father's abandonment. Some men become violent with drink, while others, the criers, turn their rage inward. Such was my father. Though he had never raised a fist, his abandonment was sufficient to take things from me that I could not explain or replace. But if he had left me broken, Faye made me feel whole. And this realization frightened me more than all my father's drunken binges, for I knew Faye could not last. I knew it from the moment we first kissed. I reminded myself, as she comforted me at my mother's funeral, this was landscape I was certain of. I could see it. Her father demanded it. Faye was only a matter of time. So why, then, didn't she go? The Arcadia Care Facility sat on a sloped parcel a mile up Ogden Canyon, housed in one of the city's oldest standing mansions, a gabled stonework edifice rising to bright red shingles 3 stories above the canyon roadway. It was less than 2 weeks after my mother's death that I went to the nursing home, seeking employment, leaving my car where the parking lot snow had been plowed up into a 6-foot bank. Despite the chill, occupying an inert rocking chair on the home's front porch, sat the blackest man I had ever seen. He was scant of height and lean, and his face was tainted with silver stubble. His eyes were cavernous with age, which rendered them as black as a well of India ink. He wore a faded vermilion jacket and threadbare denim trousers, his right pants leg tied up above the knee where a leg had once been. A single crutch lay against the side of the chair and would have fallen had there been any motion. A thin stream of smoke curled from the tip of the cigarette that burned from his mouth. He looked impossibly old, I thought. I tipped my head to the man.
Morning.
He remained silent. His ebony eyes flitted about, but did not settle, quickly returning to the static white panorama that stretched before him. He suddenly broke out in a fierce cough. I walked past him into the home. There is a distinct odor to most nursing homes, an olfactory soup of medicinal properties. But it was not so severe in the Arcadia, as if the walls of the old home breathed in the pungency and exhaled their own wooden bouquet. The foyer was broad, and at the east end was a curved, spindled staircase next to a modern elevator, where several residents in wheelchairs sat. To the rear of the foyer was a formica counter, behind which sat a young, pretty woman dressed in hospital blues. She had thick, dark eyebrows and sienna eyes and cropped sable hair. Her complexion was sallow, more so in contrast to the darkness of her features. I guessed she was a couple of years older than myself. She followed my approach with apparent interest.
"What can I do for you?"
she asked sweetly.
"I've come to apply for a job."
I fumbled inside my shirt pocket and extracted the mortician's card and set it on the counter.
"Roger from the state morgue said I should come by."
She gave the card a cursory glance.
"To help increase business, no doubt,"
she said sardonically.
"You'll need to see our director. I'll see if she's available."
She disappeared behind the counter through a back office door, returning a moment later, followed by a corpulent woman with a pleasant face and a radiant mane of red hair, with curls as wide as juice cans. The woman wore a luminous fuchsia blouse, partially concealed beneath her white smock. The ensemble was accented by thick plastic beads.
"I'm Helen Staples. May I help you?"
she asked, extending her hand.
"You are the director?"
"I'm the boss,"
she replied brightly.
"Roger Clemens at the morgue told me that you were looking for help."
She lifted the card from the countertop, then looked me over.
"Roger, huh? Have you any direct patient care experience?"
"I've spent the last 2 years caring for my mother."
"Your mother is elderly."
"She had terminal cancer. She died recently."
Empathy crossed her face.
"I'm sorry to hear that."
She handed back the card.
"Come on back to my office."
I followed her to an adjacent room, overcrowded with books and file folders and glossed paper boxes of medical supplies. There was a method to its disorder, and if things were in piles, they were, at least, in organized ones. Behind her wooden desk, a metal radiator painted the ivory of the walls, groaned beneath its task. Thumbtacked to the plaster wall was a large laminated calendar with illegibly scrawled notes indicating the month's activities. On the desk was an open box of powdered donuts. Helen sat down across from me.
"Oh, tell me about yourself. Are you from the area?"
"I live down 24th, just west of the viaduct, behind the Union Station."
I was accustomed to receiving an adverse reaction whenever I shared my address, verbally or otherwise, but Helen showed no sign of trepidation.
"Are you a college graduate?"
"I was in college, but I had to drop out to take care of my mother.
I'm hoping to start back next fall and work evenings.
So you would like to work days until fall, then move to the night shift?
Yes, ma'am. She seemed satisfied with the proposal. She leaned forward, laying her arms across her desk.
What exactly did you do for your mother?
I was all the hospice she had, so I did pretty much everything. Cooked, fed, bathed, toileted her, helped her with her medications.
Do you have any full-time work references?
I worked at Heller's grocery store for about a year, but they won't give much of a reference. I had to leave my shift several times because of my mother. My manager gave me a bad time about it. If I hadn't quit, I suspect he would have fired me. She looked at me circumspectly.
I appreciate your candor, Mr.
Keddington. Michael Keddington.
Michael, you haven't hurt your chances with your confession.
No one here is paid enough. You have to care about these people. Frankly, I could train a monkey to change bedpans, but if you don't care... Well, I can't teach that. She suddenly glanced back toward the front counter, and I wondered if this was in reference to the young woman who greeted me.
How much does the job pay?
$1,400 a month to start, with a performance raise in 6 months, plus meals in the cafeteria. Some don't consider that much of a perk. That's more than I made at the grocery. If that's satisfactory, when can you start?
Are you hiring me?
No offense to you, but we're desperate. We've been short-handed for 2 months, so the sooner the better. We'll need to see that you're certified as a nurse's aide, but we can do that in-house.
I can start right now.
She stood, evidently pleased.
Splendid! One of our aides called in sick, so I was about to change bedding. I'll have you accompany me. It will give you a chance to see the place and meet some of our residents.
She stepped from behind her desk, looking me over for height.
How tall are you?
I'm about 6 foot.
I'll get you a pair of blues, but until then you can just wear a smock.
She removed the garment from a woodlocker and handed it to me still on its hanger. I pulled it over my street clothes as I followed her out into the hallway. We paused again at the front counter.
Alice, this is Michael. He'll be joining us as a CNA.
Alice smiled as if this was to her liking. She stretched forth her hand.
Welcome to our Greek paradise.
Helen did not smile, and I sensed tension between the two women.
Is Wilma's medicine in?
She asked.
Not yet.
Let me know when it's delivered.
The very minute,
Alice said buoyantly. She again smiled at me.
I look forward to working with you, Michael.
Helen started off, orating like a tour guide sans bullhorn.
The Arcadia is a county-operated extended care facility.
We have 39 residents here today. We can accommodate up to 46.
Our population changes weekly. Most of our residents require around-the-clock supervision, though there are some here just because there is no place else for them to go. We keep 6 employees on staff 24 hours a day, not including the meal crew. The office, cafeteria, therapy, and recreation room are all on the first floor. Residents live on the second and third. It's not the best layout for a care facility, but the residents like it.
She pushed the elevator button and the door opened.
It feels more like a home than an institution.
We exited on the second floor, and Helen stopped to hold the door for a small, bent woman pushing an aluminum walker.
How are you today, Grace?
She asked cheerfully. The woman looked bewilderedly into Helen's face.
Who the hell are you?
Helen smiled.
I'm Helen. I'm the director here.
Oh,
she said, and pushed on into the elevator.
It's a daily event, Helen explained.
We walked to the nearest numbered doorway.
This room is Stanley's.
A wry smile crossed Helen's face.
You'll enjoy this.
She knocked gently before slowly opening the door.
Hello, Stanley.
Across the room, an elderly man with tousled gray hair backed himself against the wall. Though stooped with age, he was still nearly a head taller than I. To his side was a nightstand crowded with religious icons and a plethora of candles of varying sizes and tints, none of which had ever been touched by flame. He stared at us with wild eyes, agitated at our intrusion. He suddenly erupted,
"Depart, you filthy demons of the infernal pit!"
Helen appeared unfazed by the attempted exorcism.
"Stanley, we're going to change your bedding."
He snatched from the ledge a wooden cross and a large print Bible, holding them both out at us.
"I rebuke you, foul dumb spirits!"
He pointed the cross at me, his eyes dully glowing.
"Blasphemer!"
he shouted.
"I have rebuked you, blasphemer! Depart! Depart!"
When I did not, he lowered his head and side-shuffled to the corner of the room. He sat down in a wooden chair and rocked forward and back, his arms crossed over his holy paraphernalia. Helen waved me forward, and we pulled down the sheets as the man watched in agony as we performed the demonic ritual. We finished the bed, emerging from the room with an armful of wadded sheets. Helen was more amused with my reaction than Stanley's display.
"What do you think of Stanley?"
"Is that normal?"
"For Stanley, it is. Actually, he was in rare form this morning. He usually just damns me to eternal hell," she added. "I think it would have been a kick to see him 20 years ago."
"He was a preacher?"
"An accountant."
As we walked to the next room, a wheelchaired woman with oxygen tubing running up to her nose followed me with her gaze. She forced an awkward wink. I smiled at the woman, and she winked again.
"What do I do if they're still in bed?"
"We usually have them get up. We reposition bed-bound patients every 2 hours to avoid bed sores. I'll have Alice show you how. She is one of our attendant RNs."
"Have you been here a while?"
"Since the Arcadia opened. But I've worked in nursing homes since I was 17. It took us almost an hour to work our way to the next floor. We started at the furthermost doorway on the hall.
"This next room belongs to Esther. You can expect her to be inside. She doesn't mingle much with the others."
"Why is that?"
"In part because she's now nearly blind. But she stayed apart before that."
Helen knocked on the door, then slowly opened it. Across the room, an elderly woman sat in a glider of stained maple, fervently crocheting. The room was smaller than the others, allowing only one bed. It had a vaulted ceiling and a gabled window well. The seated woman was not unattractive. Her hair was thin, turned the silver of platinum, and her skin was translucent, like fine porcelain, grown less opaque with years as it does with the elderly. Across her lap lay a rust and brown macrame afghan. On the wall above her head was a framed cross-stitch that read, "Old age ain't for sissies." The room was small and tidy, and a scented candle burned and filled the room with lilac. A steel-framed hospital bed sat in the center, offset by a walnut bureau with an ornately framed looking glass. The cabinet's antique veneer was covered with a white lace embroidery beneath pastel-labeled bottles of perfume and ointments, an aged leather-skinned Bible, and 3 picture frames of varying sizes. The center picture was in a horizontal frame of varnished hardwood, an aged photo of 5 sullen-faced soldiers clad in the vestments of some war. The photograph to its left was of more recent vintage, a soldier wearing a newly issued uniform and the imperious smile of youthful zeal, both untainted by the actuality of combat. The third picture, set in a rococo pewter frame, was of a beautiful young woman.
"Hello, Esther,"
Helen said.
"Is there somebody with you?"
the elderly woman asked.
"Esther, this is Michael. Michael will be giving us a hand here from now on."
"He is a new employee?"
"Yes, he just started today."
Her hands continued in fluid reverie.
"I suppose that will be all right."
Helen walked to the candle and blew it out, confiscating the book of matches that lay next to it.
"Esther, you know you're not allowed to have an open flame without someone being in the room with you."
"It was starting to smell like an old folks' home in here."
Helen faintly grinned, then said to me,
"Go ahead and finish the third floor, then find me downstairs when you're done."
In Helen's absence, the room fell silent, and the woman returned to her own seclusion, as if all humanity had left the room with Helen. I began to dissect the bed while the woman's nimble hands continued,
methodically creating something she could not see. I drew down the sheets, then gathered them into a pile. The silence grew uncomfortable. "I'm Michael," I said.
"So I heard."
I glanced at the portraits on our bureau. "Are these pictures of your family?" There was a protracted pause.
"Is that of concern to you?"
I turned back to the woman. "No, I was just making conversation." She did not speak again, so I aborted the attempt and went back to my work, laying the new sheets on the naked mattress.
"One of them is the photograph of the soldiers. That is my father to the left."
I looked back at the photograph, studying the somber-faced trooper.
"They never smiled back then."
"They smiled all the time, just not for photographs."
I looked back at her, not sure if I should risk another question. "This other picture here, is it of your husband?" She did not answer immediately, then demurely replied,
"No, it's not."
I turned my attention to the last of the pictures, a posed, ancient portrait of a woman. Her face was delicately shaped, pale and smooth as if sculpted of marble.
"That last picture is of me,"
she said without prompting.
"I was beautiful at one time."
I turned to see if I could distinguish the resemblance.
"Have you any photographs?"
she asked. I thought the question odd for a blind woman.
"Not with me."
She looked disappointed, as if she had been cheated.
"What do you look like?"
"I'm 6 foot. I have brown hair and blue eyes."
"How old are you?"
"I'm almost 22.
"Are you married?"
"No."
"Are you homely?"
At that, I wished I had not drawn her from her solitude, which perhaps was her intent. "No."
"You sound reasonably attractive,"
she said curtly. "How does one sound attractive?"
"Close your eyes when the television is on. You can tell. Except that everyone on the television is usually beautiful. That's why they're there. You can bet no one in here would wind up on the television. Except maybe you. You sound attractive."
I finished tucking in the corners of the bed. "Alice is attractive."
"They would never put Alice on television with that scowl."
"How do you know she scowls?"
"She speaks with a scowl."
"Well, I've never seen her scowl," I said.
"You will."
I gathered up the sheets. "I better go now."
"You'd better."
"I'll see you later."
"I suppose that can't be helped."
I gladly left the room and made my way through the rest of the floor without incident, with the exception of one female resident's screaming fire when I entered her room. She continued for about a half hour in increasingly shrill bursts until Alice came to my rescue. When I had finished the floor, I carried an immense bundle of linen to the laundry room, then found Helen downstairs in the day room, where a half dozen residents had parked their wheelchairs around a color television to watch Hee Haw. The set's volume was peaked so that the twang of banjos echoed throughout the room.
"All done?"
she asked over the din.
"I got every bed I could find."
"How was your visit with Esther?"
"Tolerable."
"That bad?"
"She's a surly woman,"
I observed. Helen accepted my assessment with lightness.
"Those with the softest hearts build the hardest shells,"
she smiled.
"You'll have to get used to her. She needs to get out of her room more, and I need you to walk her."
Walking her was a charge I did not look forward to. The rest of the afternoon I followed Helen around as she introduced me to duties and patients with equal passion. As garish as she appeared, Helen was genuine and kind, and treated the residents with dignity and their antics with humor. At 5 o'clock, Helen gave me my weekly work schedule and clocked me out for the day.
I arrived home to find Faye's silver BMW sided up to my front curb, exhaust coming from her tailpipe. Faye was inside the car, fully reclined. She wore a long coat and was reading a book. I knocked on the window, and it startled her. She smiled as I opened her door.
"Hello, handsome," she said, kissing me. "Where have you been all day?"
I crouched down on my heels against the curb. "I started my new job."
"At the nursing home?"
"They were pretty desperate." Faye smiled contently.
"I'm happy you got it. A nursing home is a better fit than the produce section of Heller's."
She stretched her arms around my neck.
"You're very compassionate. An eggplant doesn't appreciate it."
I noticed the pile of books on the passenger seat. "How long have you been waiting?" She reached forward and turned off her ignition.
"About 2 chapters of Kant."
I took her hand and helped her from the car. "Why didn't you wait inside?"
"I did, but it got too cold inside, so I came out to warm up."
We started toward the house.
"I found out last night that my father has been listening in on our calls."
I looked at her incredulously.
"He has?"
"Based on my conversation with him last night, it appears so."
"You'd think a chief surgeon would have something better to do."
"Than look after his little girl? Not likely."
She glanced down at the waxed bag of donuts I had picked up on the way home. I tilted it toward her. "Donut?"
"Tell me that's not dinner."
"You don't like donuts?"
"I'm making dinner tonight."
"You need ingredients to make dinner." She opened the unlocked door for me.
"I know. I went shopping."
Weeks before, I had given Faye a key to my house, and this was not the first time that she had stocked the shelves. I took Faye's coat, then went and turned up the thermostat. Faye went to the kitchen.
"Hella's had a special on salmon. I thought I'd make spinach fettuccine and salmon. I hope that doesn't upset your system. It's hard cooking for someone whose diet consists solely of bagels and sugared cereal."
"And donuts."
"And donuts. Nutritionists should do a study on you."
I set the table and poured white grape juice into the glasses. Faye finished simmering an Alfredo sauce, and we sat down to eat.
"Oh, I'll be so relieved when this quarter is finished. I don't think I've ever worked so hard."
"At least there's Thanksgiving break to look forward to."
"And I am. Are you still agreeable to having Thanksgiving dinner with my family?"
"I think this is your father's idea. He hasn't had enough chances to humiliate me recently, and he's afraid he'll get rusty."
"Not a chance. He practices when you're not around."
Faye smiled sympathetically.
"He just needs to get to know you."
Faye's optimism bordered on the ludicrous.
"Any word on your scholarship?"
"Nothing since the first cut. I have an interview before the University Scholarship Committee the first week in December."
"I have a good feeling about it," she said.
"If it doesn't happen, I could always qualify for financial aid." Faye frowned. What I considered pragmatic, she labeled as pessimism.
"Tell me about your first day at work."
I set down my fork. "Well, it was entertaining. One old guy tried to cast us out of his room like evil spirits."
"Did it work?"
"Eventually, but not before I changed his bedding."
"Is that what you do? Change bedding?"
And other glamorous chores, like changing bedpans and shaving 90-year-old legs."
"I think it's wonderful that you're helping people."
She paused to sip her juice.
"What are your co-workers like?"
I've only met a few of them, but they were really helpful." I speared some salmon. "Outside of the residence, I think I'm the only male there." She looked up jealously.
"Maybe it's not such a good job for you."
After supper, we left the dishes and retired to the couch and television. Faye fell asleep in my arms. I woke her as Johnny Carson was signing off.
"Do you want me to drive you home?"
"No."
She sleepily kissed me, then leaned back into me.
"Oh, I shouldn't have stayed up so late. It's Chandra's wedding tomorrow."
I wrapped her in her coat.
"If it's any consolation, you went to bed an hour ago," I said.
I opened the door, and the nighttime winter air braced us as we walked out to her car. Fay shivered as I unlocked her door. Her breath froze before her.
You'll meet me at the reception tomorrow night?
I'll get there as soon as I can.
I'll be waiting for you. It will be a really nice affair.
She looked at me and again shivered.
Oh, I can't believe you came out here without a coat.
I wrapped my arms around myself.
I'm thick-skinned, I said.
We kissed again. Then she slid down into her car and I shut her door behind her. The phone rang a few minutes after she left. Fay's parents always worried when Fay was in my neighborhood after dark. Chapter 3. Henri.
Not all heroes are painted on white stallions.
Excerpt from Esther Hewish's diary. The stone-faced mansion that housed the Arcadia was built in 1818, when Utah was still a territory, unaccepted by a union that in a generation would seek divorce from itself. The mansion had once belonged to the DeLuca family, a venerable and affluent family of Tucson descent, who had migrated to America seeking opportunity and traveled west seeking gold. As they were a moneyed family, the mansion became a place of social consequence, frequented by the area's dignitaries, the politicians and merchants who ran the territory. The family remained in the home for only two generations, when they moved on to California and the manufacture of repeating rifles, finding more gold in war than mines. The estate was purchased by then-Mayor Ardell Carnahan, who occupied its opulent halls until 1876, when he fled the town after embezzling a sizable amount of money from the city coffers. The mansion was purchased from the city and became the Arcadia Paradise Inn until 1929, when the Ogden Canyon Trolley ceased its operations and the inn fell into bankruptcy. The home was boarded up and sat vacant until it was discovered by transients and became a flop house. It was not peaceful then, for men fought for the possession of a home they did not own, and at least two men were killed under its roof, seeking only its shelter. 6 years later, the estate was purchased by an eccentric Austrian man who lived on the second floor of the house and used the main floor for livestock. Swine and asses dined where politicians once had, and this he found fitting. The man's hermitry was successful. When he died of natural causes, he and his animals were not found until a year later by trespassing hikers. The property was acquired by the county for tax delinquency, and used to house machinery for canyon maintenance up until 1973, when, with the stroke of a pen, the home was designated as a rest home for the elderly. With bureaucratic zeal, the home was institutionalized. Carved rosewood bookshelves were removed to accommodate sheet metal filing cabinets. High coffered ceilings were concealed beneath hung ceiling tile, while bolts of thin industrial carpet smothered polished wooden floors and parquets. Still, the mansion's core beauty, born of craftsmen who left a portion of their soul with each gouge of a wood chisel or scribe of a marking knife, could not be silenced. When I arrived at work a few days later, dawn rolled across the Arcadia in a thin fog, settling in the terraced cliffs of the canyon and pouring out into the valley like a tributary into a vast sea. I was met on arrival by Helen near the front entryway. She was pulling on a fur-lined parka. Are you leaving? She nodded.
I was just waiting for you. I need you to drive Henri to the Veterans Hospital. His bronchitis isn't getting any better.
She looked at my car.
You better take the van. I'll get the keys.
I followed her back to her office.
Where are you off to?
Some fool bureaucrat wants our building for a new children's daycare.
I don't know why we're always the first neck on the chopping block. As if I didn't have enough to do without wasting my time justifying our existence. I have a friend in the commissioner's office who's agreed to help us out. I'm meeting with her to get advice.
She handed me the keys.
Do you know where you're going?
Veterans Hospital, down off Wall Avenue.
The hospital should already have his Medicaid record. Just wait there until he's through, unless they want to keep him overnight. Any questions?
Who's Henri?
He's in room 6 on the second floor. He's the black man with the amputation.
I'll get right to him. Henri's room was a study in the Tao of yin and yang. He shared the room with another man, and though their quarters